from Vision Australia Radio, it's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from my producer, Lloyd Shirley. Today I'll be talking to the urbane Tony Walker, author of the recently published Vintage Tasmania, the complete book of Tasmanian wine. But first, my wine of the week is a 2013 Spy Valley Gewurz Tremina from Marlborough, New Zealand. Alcohol, 14%, screw cap seal, great value for money. Made by Paul Bourgeois in a medium to dry style. Recommended cellaring for about 5 years. One of the best Gewurzes I've tasted in a long while. I first encountered this exquisite wine at the recent 2014 New Zealand Wine Awards lunch in Melbourne. It was well paired with a Spring Bay scallop cheves, with chive sprouts and a Chardonnay dressing, and it literally wowed me on first acquaintance. I enjoyed a second glass matched with grilled prawns and a mango mayonnaise dressing and green salad, and on both occasions the wine was outstanding. Straw in colour with an extravagant floral nose, redolent of rose, more rose and honeyed lychee, with citrusy and spicy apricot overtones. It opened up beautifully. Its power, texture and layered fruit complexity crept up on the palate to unravel its rich flavours. Very aromatic vintage and a fine acid backbone and lingering finish. A sublime wine in every sense, ideally suited to serving with ripe, soft cheese. As the Wall Street Journal's wine critic Jay McInerney would say, it's a Marilyn Monroe of a wine. Spot on, Jay. Now, despite producing less than one half of 1% of Australia's production, Tasmania captured 24% by value of the Australian market for wines over $15. So, if you want to know about Australia's cool climate and sparkling wine capital, I suggest you get hold of a copy of Vintage Tasmania forthwith. Pour yourself a Tassie Pinot and enjoy this excellent, entertaining portrait of Tasmanian wine, its people, places, history and contribution to Australian wine. Now let's meet its author, Vintage Tasmania, Tony Walker. Tony has had a long involvement with food and wine, and wine and food, starting with Penfolds Wines in Sydney, and going on to work as a wine educator and food and wine journalist in Tassie, of course, writing for the Sunday Examiner and the Tasmanian Life magazine. Tony, welcome to Grapevine.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, Tony, to put Tasmania in perspective, how many hectares under vine are there presently compared to, say, 2 decades ago?
The growth here has been pretty slow. Even today, with all the praise and medals and trophies Tasmania's won, we've only got about 1,500 hectares under vine. And that's very, very small in the national scene and the international scene. So one of the things that I looked at in the book, I guess, was why it's grown as slowly as it has.
Yes.
And I think that's an interesting question.
Yes. Look, compared with other well-known cool climate areas like New Zealand's Marlborough, I think that's got 25,000 hectares, and even Oregon in the States has got 8,500 hectares. So it's a minuscule size, isn't it?
It is, and both those areas started around about the same time as Tasmania.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Commercial development started in the 70s, and yes, and Tassie's been, and I think in lots of ways we've been lucky that that's happened, because we've avoided that boom-bust cycle, and we've had a chance to make our mistakes on a fairly modest level.
Yes.
And really, no matter how good the science is, there's only one way you learn.
Yes.
In viticulture, and that's by trial and error.
Yes.
So I think what we can do now, we can say with confidence, anyone coming into Tasmania, that we know how to grow the grapes, how to make the wine, and the areas to go to.
Now, Tasmanians generally don't take too kindly to cocky mainlanders crossing Bass Strait and telling them what to do. How long did it take you to settle in and shed your somewhat robust Sydney image? Because people from the Hunter never stop talking, you know. I'm not saying that's you, but you know what I mean. There is a difference in culture, isn't there?
It took us a while to slow down to Tasmanian pace, I've got to admit. But we are well and truly slowed down now, thanks, and I'm sure I'll live longer and happier because of it.
Good, good.
But I think probably even with 40 years under the belt and three Tasmanian children, I don't think I'm still regarded as a Tasmanian.
Yeah, right. Now, Tony, the Tasmania punches above its weight in premium cool climate viticulture and winemaking is due, for the main part, to the efforts of four men who laid the foundation for today's wine industry. Now, rather than talk about the wine first, I'm going on the other side, talk about the people. Who are those four people, and how would you describe their individual and collective influences?
Okay, well, just briefly to give you the background, as I describe in the book, we had an early history of viticulture here in the 19th century.
Yes.
In fact, going back to 1823, which is the second oldest wine-growing area in Australia. But then in the 1870s, all viticulture stopped here, and for nearly 80 years, there wasn't a commercial vineyard in Tasmania, despite there being wine industries in every other state, including Queensland. Then it was actually started again by two immigrants, a Frenchman and an Italian, and they are two of the people that I credit for starting the industry. Jean Miguet, the Frenchman, who started a small vineyard up here at in Lilydale outside Launceston, and, of course, Claudio El Corso, who started Marilla Estate in Hobart.
And they didn't know they were both doing starting at the same time.
No, exactly, that's right. They hadn't met each other. When Claudio planted the first vines in 1958, he was totally unaware that Jean Miguet had planted in 56 up here in Launceston. But, of course, it didn't take them long to find each other.
Yes, of course. And then in more modern times, you had the widely regarded as the progenitor or father of sparkling wine. That's the late Graham Wilshire.
Yes, that's right. Graham, with the Jantz project and the partnership with Louis Roederer, the French champagne house, was certainly the father of sparkling wine here. And he's given birth to a very healthy child, too. It's certainly the strength of Tasmania at the moment. And the House of Arras and Jantz and Clover Hill are brands, I think, that every Australian recognises now.
And Andrew,
the first rank of sparkling.
Yes, of course, and Andrew Perry now has set his sail with Apogee, hasn't he?
Yes, and he's the fourth man to whom the book's dedicated.
Yes.
With Graham Wiltshire and the two originals. Andrew has finally, after being with Pipers Brook, of course, and Tamar Ridge, and he's settled down on a small, I guess you'd call it a retirement vintage vineyard. He might not like me calling it that, but it's only a couple of hectares, and he's trying to prove a point. His theory is that the reason that French wine is so preeminent is that it's, generally speaking, meticulous attention to small plots. As you would know, in France, very often families own very small holdings as part of the great domains.
Yes.
And their job is to look after that couple of acres, and of course they get fantastic prices for the fruit.
Yes.
And they give it actually vine by vine attention.
Yes.
And Andrew's doing exactly that out at Apogee, the name of his vineyard. And so far, I've got to say, the results are proving his point.
Have you tasted the Apogee?
Yes. In fact, I was out to lunch at Andrew's on Sunday, and we tasted several of his wines.
Oh, did you pick up a bottle for me?
It's a pity we can't do a tasting on
wouldn't
on
it
radio,
be lovely?
And, yeah, look, the sparklings are, as you'd expect with everything that Andrew does, absolutely spot on, and I think that they're going to go into great things.
Yes, look forward to having some. Now for some of its wines. Tasmania's home, of course, to some stunning Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Riesling, and for that matter, some sublime Cabernet Sauvignon, as exemplified by the Domaine A, and some silky Shiraz, like the 2011 Jimmy Watson Trophy winner, the 210 Glazer Dixon Montpellier Shiraz.
That's right. Yeah.
Unheard of for a Tasmanian wine to win a Shiraz. Tony, how do you define the term cool climate? Because it's thrown about with, dare I say, I'll use an old-fashioned word, I may get into trouble for this, gay abandon these days, isn't it?
It is indeed, and Andrew Perry's very simple. I mean, there are scientific explanations of degree days and so on, but Andrew Perry's explanation of genuine cool climate is anywhere you can grow good Pinot Noir.
Yes. Yes.
And he thinks that's the absolute benchmark for cool climate because, as you'd know, in a warmer climate, it's just impossible to get that perfume and unique character in Pinot.
Well, that's a good way of explaining it to the everyday drinker, isn't
yeah,
it?
I think
because I think the industry gets caught up in mean days and average temperatures and all the variants, but a lot of people just get confused by that. But if you say, well, look, wherever good Pinot grows, that's a cool climate.
Yeah, I've got to say, Tasmanians get a little bit irritated at the number of regions claiming cool climate, which blatantly aren't.
Yes.
I mean, Margaret River, for example,
yes,
sells itself as a cool climate area, and it's just not.
Yeah.
So the term has been devalued, I think, a lot.
Yes.
And, of course, we in Tasmania claim that really this is the ultimate, probably the only genuine cool climate area in Australia.
Well, of course, it was once part of, in ancient times, Patagonia, wasn't it?
Yes, and in fact...
So Jancis Robinson told me the other day.
Yes, and joined to the Australian mainland
right.
for many years too.
Yeah, well...
You could have driven over to Tasmania.
Oh, look, I can't stand driving. It's good to get out of the car. It's one thing when I come to Tasmania, I enjoy leaving the car somewhere and walking. Let's have a Tony Walker Tasmanian wine or two of the week.
Okay.
I'll put you on the spot here.
All right. Well, I think there are three things we do exceptionally well.
Right.
I think sparkling is clearly one of them.
Yes.
And is going to be a flagship for Tasmania.
Yes.
And look, I honestly can't go past the wine I drank on Sunday.
That's and which that is the
Andrew's. Now I've got to try and remember.
2012.
I think it's deluxe vintage
or the.
It was the 2012, I think.
Yep, it must have been.
But it wasn't the, not the ordinary Apogée, it was the Rosé.
Oh, the Rosé, yes.
And the Rosé is made predominantly, of course, from Pinot.
Yes.
And that was just a stunning wine.
Yes.
And I'm not sure what its mainland availability is.
No, I think there are some Tassie wines that don't leave Tasmania.
Yeah.
Out there, and that's probably one of them.
I'm afraid so at this stage. I'm sure that he hopes that will change, but at the moment I'm sure he can sell everything he produces here.
I bet you he can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's the sparkling.
Would be my sparkling. I think the second thing we do exceptionally well, of course, is Pinot, and I think that now it's fairly well accepted in Tasmania that the South is dominating quality Pinot.
Yes.
And the areas around the Huon and the Derwent Valley particularly.
Yes.
Are looking very, very strong for Pinot, particularly, I guess, as the climate is warming.
Yes.
We're looking for the cooler areas for Pinot. And my particular favourite in the current drinking is the 2012 Derwent Estate.
Derwent Estate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right next to Steve Lubiana.
Yes.
In the Derwent, the Hannigans.
Yes. Yep.
And they have produced, the trick with Pinot, as you would be aware, is to combine that lovely delicacy and perfume with real backbone and structure.
Yes,
and they do that superbly well.
Yes.
It's by no means a light-bodied wine.
No.
But it's still got that delicacy and wonderful perfume and fragrance that you get in great Pinot.
Yes, like a velvet glove, but with a steel inner.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Mm.
And I think that vintage is particularly good.
Yep.
They've been consistently doing that over 20 years.
Right.
And it's a brand that probably not a lot of people hear of.
Mm-hmm. Good.
The third thing, and I know we do good Chardonnay, but I've got to say that my third favourite in Tasmania is the aromatic whites.
Ah, yes.
And I think we do Gewurz, we do Riesling, and we do Pinot Gris exceptionally well.
Ah, now I wonder if you do a Gewurz to match the one I was waxing lyrical about earlier. That was brilliant.
Yes, we do, and there certainly do some very good Gewürz in this state. But the wine I'd actually, and I, this is because my my short-term memory is all I've got left. Last night I drank a 2014 Tamar Ridge Pinot Gris.
Oh, Pinot Gris, yes.
And that was absolutely, it won a gold medal, I think a trophy at the last Tasmanian Wine Show.
Yes.
And it really is a stunner. And that is a wine that you would see all around the mainland.
Now, is that owned by Brown Brothers now?
It is, yes. That's one of the Brown Brothers stable.
Right.
They have the Tamar Ridge wines. Mm. And the second label is Devil's Corner.
That's right. Mm.
And, of course, they are producing some wonderful wines too.
Now, with Pinot Gris or Grigio, does it have the little indicator on the back as to style, you know, whether it's dry like some Rieslings do?
I don't think it does in Tasmania, but you can certainly be sure that any Pinot Gris or Grigio you buy from Tasmania will be dry.
Yep. Yeah.
There are, to my knowledge, no sweeter styles being made. Unlike Riesling, of course.
Oh, yes. Well,
where the trend now, of course, is to start making some sweeter Rieslings.
Oh, yes. I think I tasted some Pressing Matters. They
yes.
have the gradations made by Julian Alcorso, I think.
That's right.
Look, Riesling's fantastic, but as I think you say in the book, it suffers, it waxes and wanes because largely people don't understand it. And in the old days, of course, any old wine was called Riesling. Any old white in a flagon was called Riesling.
Yes, and they were generally fairly sweet styles too.
Oh, terrible. But Rieslings are magnificent. I think the Riesling's got a great future in Tassie.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, there's no doubt the quality's there. It's a matter of getting the public acceptance.
Yes, and that's not only for Tasmania, but that's Riesling all round. That's why they have that international, I think, indicator or scale on the back from degrees of sweetness.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And I think that's a very good guide, because who hasn't been caught by that? You've really got to know your Rieslings well, haven't you?
Exactly, yeah. And of course the current buzzword is off-dry.
Off-dry, that's
off,
right.
Off-dry can mean anything. But
yes.
It certainly means it's going to be a sweeter wine.
Yes. Now, your book is as much about, it's about the wine, but it's also a fascinating account of the people, places and events and the history intertwined or woven into the fabric of Tasmanian wine, as exemplified by Chapter 4, the Bernacchi Experiment on Maria Island. And this, of course, grabbed my attention because not long ago I did the marvellous Maria Island walk.
Oh, right, yeah.
Fantastic. And had some exquisite Tasmanian produce and fine wines.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yes, well, that was a really colourful episode in Tasmania's viticultural history. He was, as you are probably aware, an Italian entrepreneur from the silk trade in Italy who, through ill health, was looking for a kinder climate.
Yes.
And came out to Tasmania and talked the government into the lease of Maria Island. He leased the entire island and started two industries there. One was viticulture and the other was sericulture, silkworms for silk production.
That's it. Hmm.
And neither of them ever succeeded, but he was a wonderful showman.
And it was it was interesting too, because it was fascinating. The other thing, sorry to interrupt, that what I got out of your book was the links between Tasmania and the mainland, and this was an early link in this case to the Yarra Valley, and through the Yarra Valley to Bordeaux, I think, and
yeah,
parts
of
France. That's fascinating. The interaction between South Australia and parts of Victoria and Tasmania. Because we tend to think of, well, you know, one state being homogenous, but there's a relationship going on all over the place, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Bernacchi travelled to Victoria and met Hubert di Castella.
Mm.
And, of course, everyone would be familiar with St. Hubert's vineyard now in the Yarra Valley.
Mm.
And brought all his rooted vines and cuttings down from there. And as you say, they did, in fact, come from France, from Bordeaux.
Yes. Oh, look, fascinating. Of course, it was analogous that Claudio Alcorso, of course, was also in fabrics.
Yeah, he was. That's right.
And his early wines had those cloth labels. I've still got one.
Yeah,
not
that's
the
right.
wine, the label.
Well, they're a real museum piece now. Hang on to that.
I will if I can find it. It's stuck between the pages of a book somewhere, and I put it away and can't find it.
Oh, it's a pity you haven't got the bottle it was attached to.
Ah, yes. I wasn't that. Yes, yes. Very true.
But yes, he was a very wealthy industrialist, and of course a great patron of the arts, and a very prominent Tasmanian over many, many years.
Now, there are six major regions within Tassie: the Tamar Valley, Piper's Brook, the East Coast, the Derwen Valley, the Coal River Valley. I love the fruit that's coming out of Coal River.
Yes.
I've got to say, I love it.
I think Coal River would probably be our preeminent region.
Oh.
I hate to say this as a northerner,
yep.
but I think they're proving they can grow anything down there.
Yes, magnificent.
And do it well.
Yes, and the southern region, which includes, of course, you mentioned before, the Huon Valley and the Channel area.
Yep.
Now, tell us about some of these, because there's much more to Tasmania than meets the eye, because there's regional variation and style differences and nuances starting to emerge between regions, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, for example, where I am in Launceston, and there's now a sparkling wine route in Tasmania. In this region,
right
in the Piper's Brook region,
right.
Because there you've got House of Arash, you've got Clover Hill,
yes.
you've got Jance,
yes.
you've got Creglinger, you know, which is the old Piper's Brook,
yes.
You've got a whole range, and of course Apogee, Andrew Perry's wine.
Yes.
You've got a whole range of absolutely top class sparkling wine, and that's proving to be a real strength of that region.
Yes,
as I said before, the far south is producing some really wonderful Pinot, and it's looking like that probably is going to be the strength of the south, that where they have that genuinely cooler climate than the north.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a large climatic variation in Tasmania, and I think people regard it as one big homogenous region, but it's certainly not that. I mean, for example, Piper's Brook and the Tamar Valley are right side by side, but the Tamar Valley will generally ripen 2 to 3 weeks ahead of Piper's Brook.
Yes.
So there's
yes.
quite a significant difference between the valley, with a fairly warm maritime climate, and the further inland Piper's Brook.
Yes, yes.
So I think that's the stage Tasmania is going through now, the development of specialist regions.
Yes.
And I think you'll find areas that will do... Tamar Valley, for example, does wonderful Riesling, and that's going to become a real strength of the Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
Shiraz, who knows? I mean...
Well, there's enough Shiraz floating around anyway. It's Shiraz is the equivalent of the opera house of our wines, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Pinot certainly is a higher value variety, and we have a competitive advantage with Pinot.
I think what also struck me, and we're running out of time, but there's one point I really must make, and it refers to, and it's a very good point you make, and I think Andrew Perry makes it, much of the savoir-faire required for viticulture and winemaking comes as accumulated experience in a particular location, in this case Tasmania, and this may take generations to develop, and that's a quote from Andrew Perry. Now, it took Andrew 40 years to develop a refined system suited to the cool climate of northeastern Tasmania.
Yeah.
And that's a very important point, because grapes were planted that were appropriate rather than in some of the mainland areas where grapes were planted to derive the greatest yield.
Yeah, and of course...
It's an important point.
We've got to remember historically that it wasn't until the 1970s that the table wine produced in Australia... exceeded the amount of fortified wine.
Oh, yes,
so
yes.
All of those areas,
yes.
the Hunter, the Barossa, McLaren Vale, were originally planted for fortified wine production predominantly.
That's right.
Not for table wine.
Mm.
So it's hardly surprising that some of them are struggling now as the climate's getting even warmer.
Yes, very true. And I like the quote from Josef Chomri. And when people ask you, and I'm sure they ask you too, what's your favourite wine? You know, and you think, and his answer, I love his answer. My favourite wine depends on my mood, tick, the people I'm sharing it with, another tick, and with the accompanying food. Yes,
I think that's right. Yeah.
What a great answer.
Yes, well, I guess mine is constantly changing depending on what I'm drinking, you know, and the wines just seem to be getting better and better.
Yes. And I was also fascinated to learn that, like Max Allen, I had no idea that Tasmanians' first, albeit very short-lived, vines were planted as far back as 1788 on Bruny Island one Lieutenant William Bligh.
Yes, it was the habit of the colonising British and the French too, for that matter, that when they went to a new country, they would plant useful plants, trees, and vines. Both, you know, I guess, for the benefit of the native inhabitants.
Yes.
And also experimentally to see how they thrive when they come back. Of course, Bligh was aware that the natives in Tasmania burnt the land periodically.
Yes.
To stimulate new growth, and in fact was fairly pessimistic about their chances of survival. And as it turned out, he was exactly right.
Yeah, but the magnificent succulent plump oysters come from Bruny Island. Of course, Nick Haddo's magnificent cheeses.
Yes, Tasmania has got an awful lot going for it.
Yummo,
at the moment.
I know. Well, look, we're almost out of, in fact, we are out of time, Tony. Look, let's talk again maybe next year just to see how the book's gone and what thoughts and what further has developed. I'd love to talk to you again in a little while. But thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure, Michael.
And can thoroughly recommend this Vintage Tasmania. A great read, very informative, entertaining, and it's much more, it's not just about the wine. It's wine in context.
Yeah. The sad part is, of course, I haven't been able to get it into many mainland bookstores. And it's really available through the website's the easiest way.
Now, quickly give me the website address.
It's Provador Tasmania.
Provador.
Provador Tasmania, all one word.
Provador Tasmania.
.com.au.
Thank you very much, Tony. Well, that's about your lot for now. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And you too.
My research material was sourced from Vintage Tasmania, my home library, and winebiz.com. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio. Heard on stations all around Australia via Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.